Let's return to our study of the book of Ezekiel by opening to chapter number 8, and we'll go ahead and scroll back to verse number 1 to get our context right. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, that would be late August of 593 BC, as I sat in my house, and his house seems to be in the city of Tel Aviv, which is just about a day's walk southeast of Babylon City. Because remember, Ezekiel is in exile himself. So as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, so this is other members of Judean leadership that have been taken into exile as well, they have accepted that Ezekiel is a genuine prophet. So they come to sit with him and hear the word of the Lord. So while that's happening, the hand of he who is God fell upon me there. Then I looked, and behold, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire. Above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness, like gleaming metal. That's the exact same description that he gave for the vision of God about a year plus ago, when he was first commissioned as a prophet. Verse 3, he, meaning God, put out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the gateway of the inner court that faces north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw in the valley. So he testifies that he is taken away on a spirit trip. I am convinced that his body never moved from that house in Mesopotamia. God grabs his spirit body and takes it 640 miles away as the crow flies to Jerusalem. Now, I don't know if it was instantaneous or if Ezekiel was able to watch the terrain rushing underneath him as he flew to the city of Jerusalem. However way it happened, he ends up landing in the temple complex, in the courtyard in front of the temple shrine building. He's near the altar of sacrifice. And he can see God's Shekinah glory here at the temple. It looks exactly like what he saw in his initial vision with the cherubim and the whirling wheels and all the colors and the lightning, and God's sapphire throne, and his visionary form sitting upon that throne. He sees all of that, but he also takes note that on or near the gate, just north of the altar, the gate which serves as entry point from the north to the worship court, he sees an idol there that has been set up. And then he's told this, verse 5, then he, again God, said to me, son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. So look north from where you're standing. So I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance was this image of jealousy, this pagan idol. And he said to me, son of man, do you see what they're doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary, but you will still see greater abominations. So God is taking Ezekiel on a tour of the abominations in Jerusalem and the temple that's going to result in God abandoning it, his Shekinah glory leaving it, and the destruction soon following. And so the first thing he shows him is this pagan idol just north of the altar. And then he says this, verse 7, He brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, there was a hole in the wall. So he's taken to an entry point for the court, that is the worship court. But the wall has got a little chink out of it. And he said to me, "Son of man, dig in the wall. Go ahead and start digging at that chink. Make it bigger." So I dug in the wall, and behold, there was an entrance. So it got big enough that he could get in. And he said to me, "Go in and see the vile abominations that they are committing here." Now, I share with you as we're closing yesterday, I don't think that what Ezekiel does in the spirit dimension, even though it has impact upon him, has any impact upon the physical world that the spirit world is overlaying. So I don't think a hole suddenly appeared in this wall in Jerusalem. I don't think anybody can see Ezekiel. I think this is just one of those strange times where the spirit world and the physical world are being described at the exact same time. All right, so what happens when he goes in? Verse 10. "So I went in and saw, and there, engraved on the wall all around, was every form of creeping things and loathsome beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel." So this is an indoor shrine area right there connected to the temple worship court. It's a private worship site for pagan idols. And there's these idols either engraved on the wall or set up against the wall all around this room that he has dug into. But that's not the only thing he sees. Verse 11, "Before them stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel, with Yahazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them. Each had his censer in his hand, and the smoke of the cloud of incense went up." So you know that there are 70 elders that sit upon the Sanhedrin. This is the representation of the 70 leaders of the nation of Israel, which has been reduced only to the kingdom of southern Judah now. But the Sanhedrin is still there. And what are they doing? They are gathering in this little shrine room to offer incense and prayers and worship to all these idols. And Yahazaniah, the son of Shaphan, is right there with them doing all of this. Verse 12, "Then he," God, "said to me, 'Son of man, have you seen what the elders of the house of Israel are doing in the dark, each in his room of pictures? For they say, he who is does not see us. He who is has forsaken the land.'" Now, I don't think when it says here, "he who is does not see us," that they're saying that they are hidden away from him. I think based on what happens next in the phrase, "he who is has forsaken the land," is that these guys are basically saying, God's not doing anything. God's not doing enough to save us. He's not stopping the Babylonians. He's not stopping us from having people taken away into exile. And since God's not watching over us, we got to take care of ourselves with other divine beings, other gods and goddesses. And so we need to worship them here so that they will protect us. That's what's happening. Verse number 13, "He said also to me, 'You will see still greater abominations that they commit.' Then he brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the house of he who is, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz." Now, Tammuz is not just simply the name of a month. It's actually the name of a god in Canaanite and Middle Eastern mythology. And the idea of Tammuz, the month, being named after the god Tammuz, is this. Every year, after the spring had gotten a good start, the rain stopped and the heat set in. We're talking about in the month after the month of Passover. And this was portrayed in mythology as the death of Tammuz, the death of rains and coolness and the heat that dries things up. And so they would weep over Tammuz and pray for the return of the rains and the coolness. And so that's what's happening, is these Judean women are worshiping the death of God Tammuz, hoping for his resurrection later in the year. Verse 15, then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? You will see still greater abominations than these. So he brought me into the inner court of the house of He Who Is. And behold, at the entrance of the temple of He Who Is, between the porch and the altar. So the porch is the area underneath that great big tall tower that was at the front of Solomon's temple. And it had two pillars that were prominent on this porch, Yakin and Boaz. And then there were steps probably that went down to the area where the altar of sacrifice was located. And so what we see described here is this. There were 25 men with their backs to the temple of He Who Is and their faces toward the east, worshiping the sun toward the east. So you've got 25 apparently priests, because those are the only ones that should be in this area. They are standing between the front entrance of God's worship house, his shrine, and God's sacrificial altar, the place where atonement is made in the name of He Who Is. These guys are ignoring God's house and worshiping the rising sun. Verse 17. Then he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations that they commit here, that they should fill the land with violence and provoke me still further to anger? So God's question, it's rhetorical to Ezekiel, who's there in spirit form. You'd think it would be bad enough that they would insult me like this, setting up false idols and worshiping false gods and worshiping the rising sun. You would think that would be bad enough. But they're also going out there and treating other people unfairly, cheating people, murdering people to take their stuff. It is a collapse of the covenant completely. Behold, they put the branch to their nose. Now, we have no clue how this idiom got started, but we have similar expressions in our modern language that will express the sentiment that seems to be involved here. You might hear people talk about thumbing their nose at someone. And it used to be that you'd stick your nose to stick your thumb to your nose and wiggle your fingers. And this was, it was a really rude thing, a rude gesture to do to somebody. And so that was called thumbing your nose. But we've got an even worse one that I think comes closer to what they intend here. And that is flipping someone off, flipping them the bird, giving them the middle finger. sometimes in stereo. And it's the way to show you have zero respect for that person and totally disregard anything that they want you to do. And so putting the branch to their nose in the Hebrew idiom seems to be exactly that. They're basically flipping God off. And God says, verse 18, therefore I will act in wrath. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears for a loud voice or with a loud voice, I will not hear them. Remember, Ezekiel has spent over a year laying on his side with a metal grill between him and his diorama of the final destruction of Jerusalem, the siege of Jerusalem, to represent that God will not hear prayers from the people coming under that judgment, nor will he look with mercy and pity upon them. What is about to happen will happen. The full wrath of God will fall because of the sin that's involved. Now, chapter 9 indicates to me that not only did Ezekiel pass over a long distance, but he was also pulled in time forward to the time of the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, where he actually sees some of the people die as the Babylonians make their final breakthrough into the city. So chapter number 9, let's read it. Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice, saying, bring near the executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north. That's the same gate that we were talking about earlier, that has the image, the abominable idol next to it. Each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand, and with them was a man clothed in linen with a writing case at his waist, and they went and they stood beside the bronze altar. Now, I believe these six men and the seventh man who is the recorder are probably angels. They are probably watchers. And they are representing spirit realm realities. But what they do in the spirit realm will impact in the physical realm. So they represent God's spiritual judgment, which the Babylonians will carry out in the physical realm. Verse 3. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the kerub on which it had rested to the threshold of the house. Now this is where it gets both interesting and sad. Remember that the temple has the Holy of Holies back at the back of it, a cube room, which is all gold on the inside. There's two great big gold-plated olive wood kerubim that tower over the placement of the Ark of the Covenant in that Holy of Holies. But God's presence has always been associated with the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is the earthly throne of God's presence. That was the whole point. When the tabernacle was made, God's visible presence, his Shekinah glory, came up from between the cherubim. There's one on each end of that throne, the Ark of the Covenant. God's Shekinah glory came up from that point and through the ceiling and up into the sky above the Israeli encampment. When Solomon's temple was finished, God's glory came in and filled the entire temple, but was centered particularly over the Ark of the Covenant. So what we see here represented is God's glory getting up off of his throne, the Ark of the Covenant, and coming out to the porch, coming out to the front door. Continuing, verse 3. And he, meaning God, called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing case at his waist. And he who is said to him, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations that are committed in it. So God says, you, angel with the marker, go through all of Jerusalem and mark on the forehead everyone that's upset by all of these abominations. So basically, God wants all his people marked. Then verse 5, to the others, that would be the six guys with the weapons. To the others, he said in my hearing, pass through the city after them and strike. Your eye shall not spare, and you shall show no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, little children and women, but touch no one on whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. Now, if this also sounds familiar, it's because in the book of Revelation, we know that there is a marking that occurs. 144,000 virgin young men are marked as God's guys. And they become kind of the countdown clock. Once the last of them are dead in the book of Revelation, that's when God's wrath starts. So that story in the book of Revelation is similar, but not exactly the same as the one here. Here, God marks those that will survive the siege. And apparently, he picks those that are upset by how things have fallen apart. And then he turns loose the judgment on everyone else. And we've apparently got six angels that are involved in this. But when it actually happens, and remember, I think there might be a little time travel issue going on here for Ezekiel. No big deal for God. When it happens in the physical world, it will be Babylonian soldiers coming through, killing people, but sparing others to take them into exile. All right, so they began with the elders who were before the house. So the leadership that was bad, they're the first ones gone. Then he said to them, defile the house and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. So they went out and struck in the city. And while they were striking, and I was left alone, I fell on my face and cried, oh, he who is God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel in the outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem? And so Ezekiel is floored by what he's seeing. The death, the destruction, dead bodies laying everywhere in the temple complex, and more dead bodies being flung to the ground throughout Jerusalem. And he feels like it's going to be everyone dead because of sin. Now, of course, that's not going to be the case. God has already marked those that will survive, the remnant that will be used to produce the next generation of Israelis that will eventually come back and restart everything here. But he's still upset. Ezekiel is still overwhelmed by what he's seeing here, as you could expect. Verse number 9. Then he said to me, the guilt of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. The land is full of blood and the city full of injustice. For they say, he who is has forsaken the land and he who is doesn't see. Meaning God's not watching over us anymore. Well, as for me, my eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. I will bring their deeds upon their heads. So God tells Ezekiel, look, this is happening because of sin, and it is bad. And they have abandoned me. And so my judgment will fall upon them. Verse 11, and behold, the man clothed in linen with the writing case in his hand brought back word, saying, I've done as you commanded me. Chapter 10. Then I looked, and behold, an expanse that was over the heads of the cherubim. There appeared above them something like a sapphire, in appearance like a throne. And he said to the man clothed in linen, go in among the whirling wheels underneath the cherubim, fill your hand with burning coals from between the cherubim, and scatter them over the city. So as chapter 10 begins, and we're almost done with our time today, Ezekiel is zeroing in, focusing in on God's Shekinah glory cloud again, with the four-faced, four-winged, four-in-number cherubim that are underneath the platform on which God's throne rests. And he sees that God tells the man clothed in linen, which I believe is probably an angel of some sort, to go inside the circle of the four cherubim and the four whirling wheels. And there he will find apparently an altar with burning coals on it. And he's supposed to take some of those and throw them over the city. And so he went in before my eyes. And now the cherubim were standing on the south side of the house when the man went in, and a cloud filled the inner court. So what we're seeing here, and we'll come back and talk about it more tomorrow, is more symbolism of God's judgment, fiery judgment, falling, not just upon the temple and the temple complex and the temple courts, but upon the city and the countryside around it. Everything is going to get burned in God's fiery judgment. And God's presence is going to be there overseeing it in the spirit world. Because God is the one that made the covenant with Israel and said, if you do these things, I will be your God and I will dwell in your midst. But he also said, if you fail to do them, I will cease being your God and I will drive you out of my land.